I'm just going to say a little bit about what I've been trying to achieve over the next hour or so. And the PowerPoints will be available, so you'll probably be bombarded with too many names, too many scholars. The idea is to get a flavour of what I'm trying to say rather than to have a Samizdat transcription of every word. What I want to talk about is the sociology of migration, but not really just take unproblematically the sense that we might have something that is a subdiscipline called migration studies within sociology, and that we might therefore have a sociology of migration in that way. What instead I want to try and do is to actually think a little bit about how we got to where we are right now, and how it might have been otherwise, and how it might be otherwise again in the future. In other words, think about how ideas travel as much as people. And in that context, what I'm going to be trying to do is go back to in particular Thomas's work, The Polish Peasant, which hopefully has been signalled in the reading lists and so on, but also just to think a little bit about the foundational basis of the discipline of the scholarly discipline of sociology, and think a little bit about how in a sense migration features early on in the life of the genealogy of the subject itself, but also how it might disrupt a number of conceptual framings of the discipline over time. Precisely because we know we can't take the social for granted. The social is something that we study scientifically in scholarly form or otherwise. But it's also, it's an artifact. It's an artifact for those people who look for it. It's an artifact for those people who study it. It's an artifact for those people that govern it. If you follow the results of what's happening in the plenum in this week in contemporary China, part of what's going on is not only that the market will be made in forms of social reform, but also the social will be remade. So society becomes an object of fabrication itself. I know that you're on a field trip in Istanbul, and Kristen Beale, one of my PhD students, hopefully is going to be showing you around. And part of what you can't but help understand in Istanbul is the historical legacies of how an old Ottoman empire was remade, quite literally sometimes, in the image of Kemal Atatürk. Atatürk's project being very closely tied to the notion that one needed a society that was linked to a nation state that had to be fit for the modern world through processes of modernization and civilization that were accompanied through various forms of economic change. So society as an object becomes a project that is produced as a result, sometimes a failing result, of governmental intervention. So it's never straightforwardly that we can kind of look at any context whatsoever globally and think about the social in a straightforward way. In fact, as a discipline, we know that sociology is often talked about as a young discipline, but it isn't actually that much younger than most of the academic disciplines that become institutionalized in the late 19th century academy. And in that sense, as a discipline itself, you can think about the various works of social reform that characterize much of the 19th century industrial period in both the United Kingdom, United States, mainland Europe. The writings of people like Herbert Spencer, Francis Galton, social reformers in the United Kingdom with kind of curious understandings of the way in which mankind related, frequently picking up things like this form of social Darwinism, kind of investigations that Engels carried out in Manchester trying to critique the emergent forms of industrial capitalism, but also the other Victorian reformers that kind of created a context in which the study of society became increasingly normalised. But only at the very end of the 19th century do we find the foundation of formal departments of sociology. And in particular, I think you have in Chicago the first department of sociology, founded in 1892 by Park and Thomas, who we'll come back to in a second, but also a couple of years later in Bordeaux, Emile Durkheim founds the first department in France, Max Weber, in Munich in 1919. So there's a period of time when the discipline of sociology emerges. And what I want to suggest is that we can't take for granted the subject of sociology. Talcott Parsons once actually very famously defined sociology. He actually in a lecture said to economists, he said, economists study values, we study value. Exactly how economics relates to sociology, if you have time, we might kind of revisit later on. But how we think about sociology itself, I wanted to kind of take through this moment in Chicago, not to kind of focus on the United States, but just to see how some of the foundational ideas that inform the Chicago School of Sociology both draw from a particular version of the globe, draw from a particular German tradition, but then we might think about the routes through which sociological ideas spin out from that moment, and migration features in those ideas. Migration actually features in these routes that I want to trace out for you, but also migration frequently undermines some of the ways of seeing that are at the heart of the routes. So what I want to, in a sense, do is take Park as a founding place, as an interesting character who we could spend hours talking about. He's a journalist, interesting personal life, kind of character who went to Europe to be educated, was importantly, if what I'm going to be saying, was taught by George Zimmel, who we'll return to in just a second. He's strongly influenced by Zimmel, but also actually I think frequently misreads what Zimmel is saying. Something that also becomes important. But we're going to take five journeys out from Park's foundational moment of the discipline of sociology. And I won't run through those because you can flip that point later on. But in a sense, what I'm trying to get at in my notes, when I was thinking about how I introduced this morning, I thought it is a sense of what we might call sociological sensibilities. Because the argument that I want to make to you is that there are very different kinds of intellectual projects that labour under this rubric of the sociological. And in particular, how we come to think about migration is determined as much by these histories, these roots I'm going to talk through, as they are by the simple question of trying to do good research well. So the four roots that I want five roots I want to take, are pretty arbitrary. These are not to be straightforwardly believed as kind of the batons through which sociological knowledge is handed on. One of the scholars I mentioned, Walter Benjamin, says that we need to be extremely suspicious of the historical ordering of things. Chronology itself is an artifact, right? The way we order things one after another then begins to leak into kinds of causality, that something has caused something else because it follows. We need to be actually quite suspicious of its power. Benjamin actually talks about historians showing their Scotland Yard-like credentials, and we need to be suspicious of those kinds of organising principles. But the roots I'm going to be kind of tracing have a genealogical sense to them, but they go sideways to Thomas, who we'll come back to, as I said in a second, and his work on the Polish peasant was published in five volumes between 1918 and 1920. It actually looks at the links between Poland and Chicago, Oberlin and Chicago, in a fantastic piece of work. If you have no time to do anything else, I at least urge you to have a look at, spend half an hour and just even flip through it because it's beautiful in its own way. I want to go backwards from Park to Zimmel and then just think about some of those misunderstandings we were talking about earlier. Transatlantically, to back and forth across between the United Kingdom and the United States. Also forward from Park to a territory of quantification and it's kind of empirical, and some might say empiricist social science, of trying to measure things in migration sociologically. But also, what I'm going to say is diagonally to a more kind of cultural studies take on how we think about how migrants become rendered visible or invisible in studies of the social, precisely because that problem of visibility is at the heart of how we think about the subjects of inquiry. Very straightforward, if we start with Thomas, who was an Enlightenment figure in all sorts of ways. At different times he taught philosophy, psychology, psychoanalysis. He was an early follower of Freud. He taught classics and English. So he was a kind of a very multidisciplinary scholar. He was involved at the, you know, the foundational moments of the discipline of sociology in Chicago. He took almost as his kind of starting point, Nostrum, that what one might want to study is the social as a creation of the ways in which people created their own world. He had a famous quote, men define situations as real. They're real in their consequences. But the text I want to kind of just signal to you is the piece that I said took up over 2,200 pages in 5 volumes that he completed with Florian Zmianiecki, who I cannot pronounce properly, but who was a Polish scholar who later went on to work with Weber in Munich. But the text itself is a study of relations between, or the text plural, a study of relations between Poland and the United States, between Oberlin and Chicago. It's an extraordinary document. Andrew Abbott, in the piece that hopefully you have all read or will read, which is in the reading list, actually makes the quote. He says, his text, endless text, frightens readers of slim paperbacks. His multi-form analysis identifies no central independent variables. Rather, the case for Thomas's importance is an historical one. From 1910 to 1940, he was one of the half dozen most influential minds in American sociology. His work shaped that of dozens of students and followers. Most important, his career captures a phase of American intellectual life that is all too easy to read teleologically as an imperfectly realized version of our own. His career ended up in disgrace when he was discovered in a hotel room with someone else's wife, which at the time caused great problems to the University of Chicago, since one of their main funders threatened to withdraw their funding if he wasn't sacked. So even though he was actually found later innocent of indiscretion, they didn't actually remove his sacking. And part of the story of Thomas is how he was kind of erased from the academic discipline, particular moment in time. If we had more time to go into it, we could discuss that. But the point I want to suggest to you is that when you read, if you get a chance to read The Polish Peasant, that one of the things Thomas is most interested in is not straightforwardly in explaining certain kinds of social reality as just describing them. And this distinction between what is a description and what is explanation is actually quite important at this foundational moment in the discipline of sociology itself, because description itself is not an unproblematic task. It relates to certain kinds of knowledge production, and it potentially can avoid, or at least certainly avoid, starting with some sort of model of causality. But what we are trying to do is to explain something because something else happened. What one is trying to do is engage with a certain reality, and what is used in the evidence of Polish peasants include all sorts of, it includes bits of data, it includes statistics, but it also includes letters and accounts and interviews and stories and fiction and fact. It's a kind of network of different sorts of material that are used as evidence to try and characterize what is going on in terms of relations between Poland and the United States at the time. And one of the things that Andrew Abbott goes on to say is, posing the question, what is the basic intellectual contribution of the Polish peasant, is more or less like posing the question, what is the basic idea of war and peace? And the Polish peasant later, in the kind of the erasure of Thomas himself, is often described as lacking scientific rigour. One of Thomas's own students, in a sort of almost like a Peter moment of betrayal, kind of attacked Herbert Blumer, actually described it as lacking scientific rigour in the 1930s, when he actually is trying to defend ethnography as a way of knowing the social movement. It's another Chicago school student of Thomas. But it sits there as this kind of incredibly important monograph, or set of monographs at the start of the discipline. But the things I want to say there, just to give you a sense of where it leads to, is there a string of ethnographies that are produced in the wake of Park and Thomas's studies of migrant life. They particularly focus on students of both Park and Thomas. Many actually of the early Chicago School monographs actually appear to owe more to Thomas than to Park. We'll come back to that in a second. But there are kind of the famous Chicago School ethnographies of people like Lewis Worth, or later, about 15, 20 years later, in the 30s, 40s, William Fitzwhite's Street Corner Society, that tried to understand the complexity of everyday modern life in America through its roots that have been generated transnationally. I think, interestingly, in Thomas's work, there isn't any kind of straightforward understanding of migration that separates sending societies and receiving societies. There is a reality that is foundationally transnational at its original moment. He's interested in the way people keep in contact with their relatives as much as he is about the ways in which they assimilate to this new world. It actually links the point of some of these journeys that I wanted to take you through. There are people that immediately pick up on the Chicago School of Ethnographies in very different disciplines. So Malinowski in London School of Economics in the Foundational Moments of Anthropology is reading much of this work. It travels transnationally, so the kind of foundational scholar of social science in China, Fei Xiaotong, from the soil, actually is a student of Malinowski, is also reading some of the Chicago School of Ethnographies. So these ideas are travelling around the world at this particular moment as the students emerge from late 1930s, 20th century universities, begin to go to other places to study the social, to make visible the processes of migration in very different global contexts. In the British case, there are a series of studies that, in a sense, take a leap from Chicago, particularly in the post-war moment when the United Kingdom is characterized by major migrations from the new Commonwealth, from the Caribbean and South Asia in particular. And scholars who are quite consciously reading Robert Park, people like Michael Banton, who's still alive, produces a book, The Coloured Quarter, about Cable Street in East London in 1955. Anthony Richmond that has a kind of slightly more mixed quantitative, but also ethnographic study of migrant workers in Liverpool. She's actually curious. Actually, I'm going to take it. So be careful. And it is curiously interesting in its accuracy, if I can put it that way. And Banton's work is more straightforwardly an engagement in the lives of this strange world, a strange world that Sheila Patterson, when she's kind of doing another major ethnography of migrants to Brixton, talks about the world as the world of dark strangers. Okay? So the migrant becomes translated from these ethnographies of the modern in Chicago, in Thomas's, in my caricature in the time we've got, in the kind of caricature would be that there is something that's fundamentally transnational and multiple in its dimensions, become effectively the creation of studies of folk who arrived, these objects who arrived from strange cultures in new lands. Migration becomes, in that sense, exemplifies a particular analytical gaze. In the British tradition, that becomes subject to a very strong critique at a certain moment in time. And again, these are, if I can just repeat what I said earlier on, please don't think, kind of give you, don't worry about remembering all the names of what I'm going to say. I'm going to give you a sense of the sensibility, if you like, of the different routes that I want to take you through. But in the United Kingdom, there's a bunch of scholars in the late 1970s, early 1980s, working in particular under the direction of Stuart Hall, a graduate of the University of Oxford, former Rhodes Scholar, who becomes very interested in the workers' education movement in the 1950s, but also in creating the discipline of cultural studies, working with Richard Hoggett in Birmingham. And some of those Birmingham scholars produced a landmark volume, which is almost 30 years ago, actually. It says 81, but I think that's wrong. On the overhead, you need to check on the book. I think it was written in 81, came out in 83, in the end, I think. Which is Empire Strikes Back, which is a collection of essays written by scholars from migrant background, largely, not entirely, in the United Kingdom. People like Errol Lawrence, Hazel Carvey, Kiva Palmer, Valerie Amos, who now sits in the United Nations in position of high office, John Solomos, Paul Gilroy. Errol Lawrence, in particular, in this volume, actually critiques the ways in which sociologists have created an exoticized subject that they study, through actually making cultural difference the object of study under the rubric of migration, and therefore trying to challenge the ways in which knowledge has itself a series of problems. Now, I don't think that it necessarily excuses the academy from understanding ethnographically migrant traditions, and there are ways in which we might think about how other scholars of cultural difference, not least in a French tradition, people following Pierre Bourdieu, have thought about how migrant flows across the globe bring people together in transnational settings, not least in the cities of France, in Bourdieu's last work, The Weight of the World, which is fantastic, which would be a great chance to read. And some of the work going on in Compass, with people like Ben Gidley, Mette Berg, Uli Jensen, also tries to think about how one might carry out ethnographies of situations of diversity. And what one of the former scholars at Compass, Stephen Birchbeck, described as superdiversity, when you find settings in the modern world characterized by intense patterns of diversity of not just migrant, where migrants come from, but also the status in terms of legality, in terms of what made them come, and so on and so forth. So the point I try to make in that particular route is that migration moves from a Chicago school tradition through a sensibility of studying difference to, if we're not careful, exoticizing difference. And that might alert us to the kind of talk to how we think about the objects of study in that way. Now, there's what that means, I think, is that, actually, if I just jump fairly quickly in terms of time, to the second route that is more, as I said earlier on, more from Park, I guess, than from Thomas, and is through a notion of, what I've called on the overhead here, urban ecologies, because what Robert Park was strongly influenced by, it was on the one hand Zimmel's cultural sociology. Zimmel was a philosopher of power, but also he kind of tended towards a sort of functionalist understanding of the city in particular. So the city was an organism, and the different components of cultural and social life in some ways made the city work for Park. What that meant when one tried to conceptualize migration was that it might be possible, in Park's terms anyway, to think about if we thought about the city as an ecology, then migration functionally might be understood in terms of how it worked as a factor within the architecture of that ecology. That kind of produces a particular reading of Zimmel, in just one example, which we'll come back to in a second, Zimmel, in his famous essay The Stranger, talks about how we might think about both social distance and geographical distance. What Park actually begins to read from Zimmel is a notion that one can measure social relations spatially, in the sense that if people are more separated from each other by distance, that might suggest that there is greater cultural distance between people, and that these might create the pieces of an understanding of how we measure this ecology of the city. That feeds into a tradition that strongly comes through, actually partly from Berth as well, but also from other scholars in Chicago, people like Burgess and Hoyt, to try and think about the society through the metaphor of the city, in a sense, as this functioning ecology, which has particular spatial forms, particular zones which are characterized by migration, particular zones which are characterized by transition, particular zones which are characterized by other forms of residential dissimilarity of one group from another. And that we might think about the process of migrant arrival and migrant integration into urban modern life as a process of assimilation, which was both social and spatial simultaneously. And there are the kind of famous models that should have come out of the Chicago School that begin to be part of the ways in which, ironically, I guess, if you look at, and again, Andrew Abbott is an interesting methodological scholar who has written a history of Chicago as a department in sociology, makes the point that Chicago kind of begins as this foundational site of multidisciplinary, highly qualitative studies of the sociological, and ends up a number of decades later being a site where the dominant form of American sociology is highly quantitative and measuring most things. Now, this transition from the qualitative to the quantitative is partly mediated by this ecological turn of Park, a reading of this notion that one might think about social distance and spatial distance in a particular fashion. It has other legacies, partly, and again, I think I might jump a little bit on this given the time, but it has legacies that feed into mainstream sociologies of the 1960s and 1970s, particularly the figure of John Rex, and also to some extent Manuel Castells, who I'll return to in a second, but who pick up also from that Chicago school tradition an understanding of the dynamics of city life. And in John Rex's work in the 1960s and 1970s in particular, he tries to talk about migration to the United Kingdom through an understanding of the urban system. So international migration is mediated by the process of arrival in cities, settlement in cities, and assimilation to host societies. In order to understand that process for Rex, what one needs to understand is the mechanics by which this organism of the city works, and the mechanics by which, in particular, people are sorted into particular occupations and particular geographical areas of residence. So what John Rex does in two very important books, one with Robert Moore and one with Sally Tomlinson, in the 1970s and 1980s in England, that become quite influential internationally in sociology, is try and, if you like, take the Chicago School model into a post-war social setting where he produces analysis of what he calls housing classes in particular. So the argument that Rex makes, again, interesting enough, looking at the city of Birmingham, where Stuart Hall and his colleagues were working at the same time, and it's a very, very different intellectual tradition. But what Rex produces is an understanding of what he calls race relations sociology that emerges from processes of migration. John Rex's argument is that what he calls race relations situations are produced by migration, but are then fundamentally overtaken by the dynamics of urban change, which actually begin to create this patterning of society, this thing that's called society, again mediated by the city, but this patterning of society through the ways in which residential space is organised and the ways in which employment allocation is organised. Interestingly, in Manuel Castells, who's writing at the same time as John Rex, but initially in France and Spain and then subsequently in California, becomes a kind of mainstream figure in sociology through a position that is strongly critical of Rex in the 1970s, when he tries to argue that we have to understand the urban problem through a much more kind of Marxian frame. But in his kind of mid-career work in the 1980s, begins to create a model of the social world through his book, The City and the Grassroots, which becomes quite close to a Rexian model, where he argues that, in a sense, through a combination of collective protest, social movements in the city, and also how the city works as a space of what he describes as collective consumption, again, the city becomes a determinant of a certain kind of class formation, which in the context of migration means that, again, what one studies as an object of study is the institutional form through which society, or the urban, become the structuring forces that determine where migrants sit in the social world. So again, the point that I tried to make, in a way, is that in itself becomes criticised by a strand of Marxian scholars, not least people like Stephen Castles, who was formerly here at Oxford, but also Robert Miles, who try and suggest that what you end up doing, if you look at things that way, is turn this thing called race, which is, if you like, a fiction in all sorts of ways, into an object of study, and by becoming an object of study, it becomes rarefied and understood almost unproblematically. So race relations, whether we're talking about the United States of America or various European contexts, or increasingly contexts in colonial or post-colonial settings such as Canada, Australia, becomes, in the Marxian critique, becomes unpacked, and race becomes seen as much more contingent. If I had more time, I'm going to go into a little bit more detail, but for the moment, all I want to say is just What's interesting about that tradition is that, on the one hand, it begins to re-centralize the importance of migration as a way of thinking about race. So Stephen Castles, in his early work with COSAC, talks about European migration systems and how they specifically undermine logics of race in the United Kingdom, but also the particularities of individual European countries in terms of the way they begin to talk about migration situations. What also, at the same time, I just want to signal is that there is, in the discipline of geography, a very straightforward reading that comes out of that Chicago School tradition that increasingly focuses on levels of separation of one community from another. That point I made from that Robert Park took from Zimmel, that social distance and spatial distance might be read off one from another, is taken into a certain geographical tradition. In sociology in the United States, authors like Tauber and Tauber in the United States, but in the United Kingdom, particularly associated with the School of Geography here and one or two other departments of the country, which tries to measure social pattern by the distance that separates different groups and sees how that changes over time. Now, these measures, quantitative measures of residential dissimilarity, are increasingly inform debates about segregation of migrant groups in post-migration settings, but also they begin to shape a debate about how and what is being measured at the time. We'll come back to that. Just shortly. Okay, the third of the five groups I want to take you through is actually by questioning a little bit about what is actually going on in this process right at its very roots. If we go back to that moment in Thomas and Park's determination to understand what's happening in the modern world of the late 19th, early 20th century. There is a sense in which there sits you with people like Galton and Spencer and others, that the discipline of sociology, you can trace back, be it behind those institutional forms of departments of sociology in big Western universities. In fact, one of the arguments that's made by a school of historian, social critical inquiry type scholars of today is that we might want to think a little bit about how the social becomes almost invented in the 19th century as an object of concern. And this is most straightforwardly identified with a certain kind of thinking linked to the French late French scholar Michel Foucault. Mm-hmm. But the argument kind of stretches out across a number of disciplines inside and outside the social sciences, and they would go very crudely, roughly along the following lines. That what one finds is that in the period following industrialization and modernization, starting in Manchester, if you want to get geographically foundational about these things, but found as much in France and Germany and the United States in the early industrializing countries, but also, if you think about those examples from China and Turkey, this process is not without repetition. The social becomes an object of public concern through processes of publicity, through processes of actually making public, making people worried about what exactly is going on in terms of dynamics of change. In the cities of 19th century Britain, what increasingly becomes a concern is how concentrations of extraordinary forms of poverty and social exclusion become both an object of concern by moral reformers, but also an object of analytical inquiry by people like Friedrich Engels, who begin to try to, when walking around Manchester in the 1830s and 1840s, actually begins to actually try and identify the ways in which an industrial social world is creating an increasingly patterned space that is itself a product partly of migration. And interestingly, if you look at the condition of the working class, Engels talks very centrally in that about the role of the Irish informing the growth of early capitalism. He talks about the cities of Victorian Britain being factories that transform discrete forms of humanity into uniform forms of labour. There's actually a really beautiful quote in Condition of the Working Class where he almost picks up on pieces of the body, where he talks about the factory owner that transforms, people into hands, as he calls them, to their fates. So the notion that the body becomes a mediator through which the factory uniformalizes difference is precisely essential to the ways in which industrial society works. In other words, migration in Engels is absolutely central to this factory-like uniformity that is produced by certain processes of industrialization. I mean, interestingly, Engels is actually, there's some psychoanalytic pieces that have been done on Engels that have talked about how the Irish become the other within Engels's Victorian city, but the other is also made into an animal. So there's a whole passage in the English Working Class about how the Irish sleep with pigs. Engels is writing about the Irish and the pigs sleeping together, so almost the Irish become animals in the text in ways that are not unproblematic, but at the same time, as he is being guided around Manchester by Mary Burns, who's his Irish love. So exactly who are the guides to these migrant populations at any one moment in time is precisely something that we might want to think about in hindsight. But in terms of this kind of the root, what we describe as the root of moral geographies, the point I'm trying to make is that there is a tradition of scholarship that thinks that how we consider the invention of the social, the delineation of territories of sociological inquiry, if you like, needs to be put into a particular context. That was a kind of signaling a digression on this. The work of W.E.B. Du Bois is actually incredibly important in this regard. And there are two, the kind of the early Du Bois and the late Du Bois. The early Du Bois of the Philadelphia Negro, where he tries to produce a study of migration from the south to the north in America, in Philadelphia, in almost a straightforward Chicago school way, which is kind of buttressed by statistics, facts, data, observation of where people live, where they work. If you take Du Bois at that point in the Philadelphia Negro and then compare what Du Bois is writing about 20, 25 years later, when in The Souls of Black Folk, what Du Bois begins to talk about is a sociology that is about the construction of the colour line, the sense in which migration itself naturalizes and obscures as much as it reveals. So the ways in which we think about the data that is at the heart of our study of migration actually might make us think about how, in, as I say, one particular tradition of scholarship, what we might understand is the vitality. There's a really beautiful piece which is, if you get a chance, if you're interested in this kind of strand of work, that Tom Osborne wrote with Nicholas Rhodes, where they talk about the vital life of the city and how morbid bodies become the focus of a certain kind of analytical concern in the late 19th, early 20th century. The city becomes a site in those metaphors of functionalism that we take from Park earlier on. They become the dysfunctional city is a site of morbidity and disease, and so it needs to be regulated, it needs to be governed, it needs to be reformed, it needs to be sanitized. So there are enormous debates in the late 19th century Victorian cities about sanitation, about miasma, about the unhealthy co-presence of bodies from different places. And so migration in this sense becomes seen as part of a moral geography of the city that is actually partly about structuring how we come to think about a sensibility of governance of particular spaces of the social. There's a sense in which, in that Osborne and Rose piece they kind of pointed to, they talk about the importance of actually trying to create not just carceral imperatives, but what they call regulated freedom. So you have to kind of create propensity to be free through having a well-organized city. You have a well-organized city by trying to distinguish between those people who belong and those people who arrive. And for the ambitions of these strategies, this is what they say, well, not only to constrain, discipline, and pacify, but also to create a certain kind of regulated, civilized subjectivity in the urban population. We see that is to say not solely a negative or oppressive kind of activity, the focus upon the identification and elimination of sources of conflict within the fabric of urban life, but rather the active attempt to fabricate liberty as a matter of free bodies in regulated spaces of the city. So that sense of mobility is partly also tied to the sense of the functioning organism, which is likewise tied to the process of civilizing the strange bodies. The project that takes Engels in his text as this kind of incredible critique of social reforms that runs through it. But the point, I guess, that the Foucauldian historians take from that point is that you then see that reformist project becomes entrenched in certain disciplines of social engineering in the late 19th century, beginning with the municipal sewers committees, but also extending to processes of education conducted by the state, the forms of health provided by the state. These forms of social reform and welfare provision need to be understood in the round as processes that have a relation to how the social body is assembled. And in that context, migration assumes a particular place in relationship to it. I just want to jump through that in a sense, just to point to the fact that there's an argument which I'm going to talk about Bridget's work. I'm going to jump back while Bridget's sitting here. But only to say that I think if you do look at Bridget's most recent book, I think that the part of that sensibility informs a lot of the debates about who is a migrant and how the position of the migrant becomes defined. It also, I think, in a perverse way, it means that the processes of immigration, assimilation, and integration become, if one's not careful, quite straightforwardly rendered visible through processes of comparative study. And I guess in the European tradition, particularly in the 1990s and early 2000s, there was a number of pieces of work, quite often associated with an Italian tradition that comes out of the University of Florence, but is European Institute, that actually tries to suggest that the study of race in both the United States and the United Kingdom has become subject to much too kind of great detail, and that what we need to do is entrench in the sociological tradition instead a much more comparative understanding of forms of modernization that link to processes of migration. In a way, this ties into some of the things I was saying Stephen Castles is talking about 10, 15 years before, but also tries to think about how migration systems, particularly in Europe, are characterized by different processes of integration and assimilation. Edwin Favell, who writes, I think, what's actually quite in lots of ways, it's a great book in 1998, Philosophy of Integration, but I think it's deeply problematic in some ways, talks about what we need to do is to move towards, he calls it a neo-positivism. So we almost create a science by which we think about how migration systems in Europe are structured by this history. So the point I'm trying to make, slightly ironic, I guess, is that there is a sense in which the comparative moment, which tries to say there is a French tradition of migration, a British tradition of migration, Italian, that is partly trying to argue that we move from this historical basis towards, again, this sense of comparing objects on a petri dish, one against another. So history becomes the framing through which a certain kind of comparative study of migration takes place. I think that's also not without its problems. As it comes to wrap up with the last couple of routes that I want to take, not least if we go back to Zimmel himself. If you my particular interest, I think Zimmel is not just foundational but incredibly important in rethinking some of the problems of the sociological in the contemporary moment, because there is another take on Zimmel. If we go back to that quote that I brought up two or three times, the stranger quote about social distance and spatial distance. The quote, and I'll get it wrong, but if not, in the notes, but in one of his famous essays, Zimmel says, is that which is close can be socially distant, and that which is socially distant can be, sorry, that which is geographically distant can be socially close. I think I've got it wrong in the paraphrase. But the point is, if you go back to the quote which becomes central to some of the things I was talking about earlier on, is that what Zimmel is talking about is the cultural construction of difference between people. And this is actually where part of what I'm going to gently suggest is that arguably Park, certainly people that read Zimmel through Park, have completely misread how we come to think about that construction of social and spatial distance, and importantly, I think, how we come to think about the process of migration. Zimmel himself is actually much more influenced by a particular German tradition, a German tradition which is in part emerges from the notion of the Bildungsroman. If you know, in the German sensibility, there is the notion of the novel. You find this in Dickens, you find this in large numbers of the kind of Victorian novelists, that somebody arrives in a place, and the novel is about how a biographical journey is tied into a geographical journey, is tied into a moral journey. And the Bildungsroman is the kind of the form through which that takes. And what Zimmel is interested in both the metropolis and mental life, and in the essays on money as well, is how the modern world, the cities of the late 19th century, have created for him a completely new way of social organisation. So very famously, what Zimmel argues is that what that means is that the city in particular, but modern society in general, becomes the source of extraordinarily excessive empirical material. Ways in which we make sense of that excess are forms of editing. If you are arriving somewhere, if you're arriving in Berlin, in late 19th century Berlin, and frankly, if you think about this and you want to try and make sense of how people arrive in 21st century Cairo or Istanbul when you go there, or contemporary China, if you're arriving somewhere, you're arriving in place, but you're also arriving in a very different sense of that term, in another world. And in Zimmelian sociology, there is a sense that process of arrival demands that process of trying to get by is a form of what Zimmel talks about as rationalization. So rationality, the rational for Zimmel, is actually a product of trying to make sense of that excess. So you move from excess to the rational by trying to confront the unknowable. So quite literally, the modern social world for Zimmel is almost beyond knowing at a certain sense. So the ways in which individuals, collectives, new arrivals, old arrivals, make sense of that excess is by trying to limit it, to edit it, quite literally to edit. Rationality becomes an edit in that way. And so the strange and the familiar in the Stranger essay are actually something very different to the way that Park in particular picks them up. And there are many other scholars who Zimmel is teaching at the same time, including Du Bois, actually. So if you think about The Veil, there's a very straight read from Du Bois's notion of the veil, which is partly through the Christian Bible, but also partly through Zimmel. But more importantly, when we're thinking about migration, it actually directs us towards an understanding of arrival as a process. It also means that we might think a little bit about how some of the other scholars who are picking up from Zimmel's lectures, some of the other students, particularly, I guess, the tradition that I can only just gesture towards, which is more the kind of German critical theory tradition. So in the lecture rooms, literally in the lecture rooms that Zimmel is giving, the Stranger lecture, the Metropolis of Mental Life lecture, you find Theodor Adorno, you find Walter Benjamin, you find Max Horkheimer. So that Frankfurt School tradition that actually tries to talk about, in Horkheimer's work in the early 1920s, how the sociological involves certain artifacts that are produced through time and through history. And certainly when, again, in terms of the time I've got left to talk to you, this has to be a kind of shorthand, but what you find in some of the long-standing correspondence between Walter Benjamin and Theodor Adorno is precisely a disagreement about how one can take that Zimmerian tradition and think about it slightly differently in ways which might make us understand the organising of the modern through these narrative spines of the temporal and the spatial. There's a quote that I've got from Adorno to use, which I now lost, so we'll leave behind. But what the point that if you just go back here to this kind of highly quantified Chicago school legacy, part of what some of the Chicago folk were talking about is Zimmel's the character of calculability. And the character of calculability is used in some of the early Chicago school writings to kind of justify that sense of measuring, that one measures flows of people amongst other social facts. In a sense, what one might take slightly differently from that Zimmerian tradition is that what Benjamin in particular is trying to do is actually suggest that the organising of explanation through either geographical organisation, so you think about Robert Park or John Rex or the sociologies of the city in Castells, to try and see that as the functioning device that explains migrant settlement, might actually be disrupted by actually trying to ask ourselves, how is space being used as an organising principle in this explanation? How is, in the context of Adorno, how should we be suspicious in Adorno Horkheimer's kind of famous work, Critique of Enlightenment, how should we be suspicious of the ways in which notions of progress make sense of social change? What it means is actually you might think about the process of migration slightly differently, being rather than just the arrival of certain social bodies in alternative spaces that are then integrated and assimilated, we might actually understand migration as being part of a much wider process of social change. I try and suggest very, very gently that what that points to is a way of thinking about modern culture as always invariably on the move. So in a sense, we are all arriving in the modern. And so the migrant condition, rather than being about strange cultures being injected into new places, is partly about how the insecurities of, if you like, existential life of one group of people sit alongside another group of people. We can't simply talk about strange cultures. We need to think about social change and cultural change simultaneously. It leads into a thinking around cultural theorists, people like Jacqueline Rosen has Sister Gillian Rose talked, I think, very powerfully about how, like, there is a kind of psychoanalytic literature that emerges from the contemporary cultural moment and how it treats that notion of strangeness and arrival. There's a sense in which one of my PhD students, Nixon Chikuresi, is actually looking at how migrants into contemporary Cairo today are interestingly both obviously structured by multiple issues of class, so you get people moving from Syria right now, also people from Iraq who are incredibly affluent, you have people squatting in settlements that are made for people who are rich in the suburbs of Cairo. These very different strands of migration are not just about, if you like, the dynamics of migration straightforwardly typologized, but also about how we think about them existentially, how you think about how people carry their future with them. The horizon of possibility of the future is partly structured by our sensibility of the past, so the past, the present, and the future being simultaneously present might make us think very differently, depending on framing the migration process. It also actually might make us, I just want to signal this at least, it might make us think about how we might, in Dipesh Chakravarti's terms, provincialize Europe. Those things that are thought of as in some way particular to the European and North American tradition and are then universalized in the discipline of sociology, which is far too fun. has been critiqued in all sorts of fields, but not least in post-colonial studies, which has tried to suggest that that there are ways in which we need to be suspicious of those temporal and geographical frames of reference. In the context of migration, I think what we're going to do is actually begin to problematise in a post-colonial fashion that straightforward narrative of assimilation of difference in certain sociologies of migration, thinking not just about the global and transnational flows of global flows and transnational links of different communities across the world, but also about how the sites of migration become particularly problematic arenas where other places and other times inhabit shared spaces with different cultures. And I suppose, I mean, certainly for me, if you're interested, the book frequently misrepresented on this, Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses, which he described once as a love letter written to London, is precisely about this kind of problematization. If you think of the opening of Satanic Verses, it begins with the kind of blowing up of the plane, the 747, and I think it's Jibril Farishta and Saladin Chamchak, who were meant to exemplify kind of Manichaean separation of good and bad, but as Rushdie makes a point in the opening of Satanic Verses, good and bad get mixed up very quickly. So as they float down to the city of London, the good and the bad are mixed up in this kind of story of difference and diversity, both in the cartography of London and the genealogy of contemporary Islam. The two planes of the novel kind of run through in a very different fashion. The point I'm trying to make, though, is that the sensibility is one where we need to think about this, the histories that are present with us, as much as the geographies that are of elsewhere and of here at the same time. So it begins to mix up the migration from society. And the final take I want to just again signal, I suppose, is again a slightly different notion as well that we might actually take from a sociology that again might start with Park and his sense of assimilation, that what might occur in process of assimilation is that the migrant, whether we're talking about a setting of 20th century America or 21st century India, Latin America, or otherwise, we're talking about the migrant actually not just being civilized in that Foucauldian sense, but also taking on board the characteristics of the arrival destination. And that this process might describe something that in certain traditions is talked about as assimilation, immediately creates a potential to study migration through various kinds of measurement of assimilation as a process, but also a reaction to that historically is a sense that what emerges is that as assimilation doesn't work as either a narrative or as a sociological process, that what occurs is a tension between those attempts to make migrant cultures visible in the areas of arrival or invisible. And this immediately becomes tied into an extremely highly ethical project, in the sense that we know that within a certain philosophical tradition we can go back a long way to think about how freedom is tied, in some ways of thinking about it, to notions of invisibility. The attempt to be free of the gaze of the powerful is precisely about the freedom to move, but also the freedom to create your own identity. Hannah Arendt talks about freedom as being the possibility of creating your own identity free of the obligations of your previous generations. That notion of freedom, of creating a new identity, is about a mobility of identity that we might think of alongside a mobility of persons, of people. But we know that if that assimilatory narrative in part doesn't necessarily work, it immediately creates debates around migration. It's partly about what is made visible through, if you like, a politics of recognition, whether we're talking about forms of cultural rights, forms of claims made in the names of migrant communities in particular settings, or forms of resistance to the treatment of migrants as different in terms of campaigning around forms of anti-discrimination. So if we think most straightforwardly in most contexts structured by migration, there is a long-standing debate that has many different sources, but I guess in sociology partly ties into the ways in which that politics of recognition plays out in demands made in the names of migrant communities for cultural rights. For example, in education, if you think about debates in the United Kingdom right now, there is a debate about the extent to which schooling reforms should acknowledge differences of religion and implicitly, by surrogate, differences of migrant background in terms of educational provision. If we think about equally, though, debates about the ways in which the criminal justice system works, which can be demonstrated in all sorts of ways to work inequitably, then part of that debate is about sociologies of treatment of migrant minorities. They're partly arguing for a process of invisibility, if you like, or erasing migrant-based difference. So that tension, the paradox, I guess, of post-migration social lives, it is about both the tensions between claims to be made visible and claims to be made invisible, are partly about, or we might think of them at least, as partly a story about the sociologies of the post-migration experience that are about how that part story of assimilation doesn't really work. It ties into all sorts of mainstream debates in normative political theory, both by B.P. Perret and Nancy Fraser and others, about how we think about a politics of recognition alongside a politics of distribution of public goods and private lives. But also it ties into, I think, a different way of thinking about the materiality of everyday life. And again, this is can only be a signpost, I'm afraid, and if you're interested in some of the literatures I'm thinking about. But that if we accept as almost a starting point in what I've just said, that we need to be suspicious of the social as an object of study, there is a school of social thinking, particularly identified with the French scholar Bruno Latour, of course, a number of others working in a similar tradition, that would suggest that the sociological is itself an artifact. And that what we might think about, one of the famous quotes that Bruno Latour comes up with, is that he says, we should always think of society as being a project that is in front of us, rather than an object to be studied that is behind us. Mm-hmm. And part of what Latour has argued is that we need to think about a sociology that, instead of trying to consider the organization of systems, like the city as a system, the society as a system, how migration would relate to either the urban system, the social system, the nation state and its kind of machine-like, Engels-like, kind of uniformalizing difference type thing, is in slightly differently. But what in Latour or Latourian sociology one might do is follow. And it's actually quite a powerful metaphor if we think about a migration or a material sociology of migration, because the argument that Latour makes is that we need to think about the combinations of cultures, political status, objects. It moves us towards something that thinks about everyday life, not to erase, if you like, migrant groups, that people come from one part of the world to another, but to think about the migration process as linking together material cultures and economic dynamics alongside certain kinds of networks. Famously, this is captured in Latour's work as what he describes as actor network theory. And the assemblage in Latourian sociology is precisely about a combination of how networks link up particular kinds of social forms and cultural forms alongside each other. It might actually take us to a slightly different kind of level. None of these roots are particularly trying to advocate that this is the way to do it. But if you think about, there's a quite a nice book by Zhang Li, Strangers in the City, about migration to the cities of contemporary China, which is not Latourian particularly, but it's a different way of, I guess, thinking about how in that particular case, rural migrants moving into the city tie into certain economic networks of social advance. It's a kind of a story of entrepreneurial links across migrant groups, but also to particular built forms. So the residence that is made alongside the economic network becomes thought through from, if you like, a different kind of lens. We might, similarly, in a completely different way, the anthropologists and sociologists Les Back in the book New Ethnicities and Urban Culture tries to make an argument that one cannot talk about migration, race and ethnicity separately, but instead we need to think about how these processes are multi-formed in place, in particular urban settings. So the point I would try and make is that there's a different way of thinking about knowledge production. So if we're going to think about the sociology of migration, we might try to, on the one hand, not to discount notions of global migration orders or sending societies and receiving societies and some of those conventional ways of thinking, but alongside that, actually think about the ways in which a network-based sociology might construct our objects of study differently. What all that tries to do, which is the final slide to wrap up really, is to try to suggest to you that you can easily find textbooks that will give you the sociologies of migration, and that will be the sociological study of the ways in which people move from one place to another. What I've tried to do is give you a flavour, as I say, of what I described at the beginning as sociological sensibilities that actually might take that discipline of sociology slightly differently, recognising that disciplines emerge in academic settings that tend to privilege a European and North American way of making sense of migration, but I think it's sometimes a slightly sloppy characterization to say that those are strictly European and North American, because the point is that the institutions may have been European and North American, but then the knowledge is travelled. Knowledge is travelled in quite interesting ways. So Fei Xiaotong becomes important in China at a particular moment. Roberto Ungo becomes particularly important in Brazil at a particular moment right now. That the genealogies of their intellectual interests have a cartography to them, but the ideas of travel. Paul Gilroy has a great book called The Black Atlantic, where he talks about the cultural traffic of ideas that run between Europe, Africa, and North America. And following those processes of travelling ideas is precisely about how we think about how ways of making sense of the social world travel alongside the people that are migrating. So I want to kind of try and suggest to you that notion of what we might understand as reflexive genealogies might structure a little bit those slightly different sociological sensibilities that we talked about at the beginning. And just, I guess, to point to a few of the hopefully barely hidden heuristic points I'm trying to make at the heart of this is that in part what that means that as scholars of migration we need to think about how the category of the migrant is constituted alongside other processes through processes of race, ethnicity, migration are simultaneously realized, and we need to understand that both in terms of traditions of scholarship as well as traditions of government and social policy definition. The things that we're looking at. It also means that we ought to think about the discipline of sociology both as a social science in heavily capitalized SNS, and what that means to make claims. I'm not trying to diminish those claims that are made in terms of forms of scholarship that rely on quantification or measurement of things. But we do need to recognise, you know, the positivist fallacy that to measure all is not to know all. So what we come to regard as scholarship, we need to subject to a degree of reflective practice. That means how we think about sociology and its relationship between the arts and the sciences actually might be inflected slightly differently. Might have been otherwise, might be otherwise again. The argument I would try and make is actually for a kind of plurality of ways of thinking about this. Also a kind of sense of epistemological modesty about the claims that are made in the context of different traditions of scholarship. So some of the people that I've tried to kind of introduce, I hope you might actually have a look at some point in greater detail as they kind of flash by in subliminal moments, and I guess everyone has to have very different favourites. But the point I try to argue is that we need to think about the ways in which different traditions of scholarship make migration visible, but also how migration actually equally it disrupts that sense of the function of the city that we saw in Robert Park's version that's translated into John Rex. John Rex's notion of migration. It actually disrupts, if you think about the Zimmel's understanding of arriving in the modern, that begins to mix up some of the language that you see about how migrants should assimilate to arrival cultures, and that you see a lot of social policy discourse. If we think in a scholarly fashion about how civilizing processes have a history, then we can look slightly differently at what's happening in contemporary China or India or Latin America in terms of the treatment of the arrival cities that shape in many of the kind of sites of incredibly rapid growth over the last 10, 15 years. So that sense of reflexive scholarship is partly what I'm trying to argue, but also one that thinks about sociology as a form of critique as well as a form of empirical investigation. And finally, I guess just to repeat where I began, that in all of this we need to think about how we organise the stories that we present as knowledge under the sign of sociology. In particular, if we organise things chronologically, we need to be suspicious of that. But equally, if we organise things geographically, the notion that we have London alongside Cairo, alongside Beijing, and we might compare them all, what does that actually mean? Or the notion that you might have the emergent economies of the BRICS is in some way comparative. What kind of geographical logics are going on here? In all of this, both the temporal and the geographical needs to be subject to a degree of reflexivity, precisely because, as I say, they make migration difficult.